This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Do you say and do things when drinking that you regret the next day? Is alcohol a problem for you or someone you really care about? Over the next hour, we'll find out how people just like you and me found sobriety in AA through sharing their experience, strength and hope. Welcome to AA Live, brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous.
Welcome to AA Live, coming to you on ORFM in Dunedin, New Zealand. I'm Michael, I'm an alcoholic, and joining me today as co-host, we've got a very special guest, the former host of AA Live himself, Martin. Great to have you back, Martin.
Good evening, listeners. It's a pleasure to be here tonight and to speak with our guest, who will be introduced very shortly. Great to be back, and I must not forget that I'm Martin, alcoholic.
And yes, so we do have a wonderful guest joining us today, all the way from Connecticut in the United States via the magic of Zoom. Our guest is Dr. Dawn Eden Goldstein, a woman whose life story is as remarkable as anyone you're likely to meet. Born and raised in New York City in a Reformed Jewish household, she began her career as a rock and roll historian and journalist, writing for publications including Mojo, Billboard and Salon, and interviewing some of the great figures of popular music. She also worked as a headline writer and editor at the New York Post and the New York Daily News. I hope I've got all of that right. But Dawn's journey took a profound turn, and she ultimately had a conversion experience that led her into the Catholic Church, and from there she's sort of launched into a remarkable second career as a theologian and scholar. In 2016, she became the first woman in the history of the University of St. Mary of the Lake to receive a Doctor of Sacred Theology degree. And she has taught at universities and seminaries in the United States, England, and India. And she is among the few laywomen in the world to hold both a theology doctorate, licensed by the Holy See, and a licentiate in canon law. She is the author of several books, but the one that brings her to AA Live today is Father Ed, the story of Bill W's spiritual sponsor, which tells the story of the Jesuit priest Father Edward Dowling, whose friendship and spiritual guidance transformed the life of AA co-founder Bill Wilson and helped shape the spirituality of AA itself. This book won a Christopher Award in 2023. Dawn, welcome to AA Live. It's a real honour to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much. The honor is all mine. I'm just so grateful to you for approaching me to be on your podcast.
Oh, we're really delighted. Before we get into the heart of our conversation, we always open the show with the AA preamble and a daily reading. That's very much part of the fabric of AA Live. So I will start by reading the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And from here, we usually do the daily reading, and I think Dawn's got a nice reflection on it as well. So I'm going to ask Martin to read the daily reflection today.
This particular reflection is dated March 31st, and it's entitled "No One Denied Me Love." It starts with a quotation from the 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions, page 141 to 142, and it goes, "On the AA calendar, it was year two, a newcomer appeared at one of these groups. He soon proved that he was a desperate case and that, above all, he wanted to get well. He said, 'Since I am the victim of another addiction, even worse stigmatized than alcoholism, you may not want me among you.'" And then there's a commentary. "I came to you, a wife, a mother, a woman who had walked out on her husband, children, family. I was a drunk, a pill head, a nothing. Yet no one denied me love. Caring a sense of belonging, today by God's grace and by the love of a good sponsor and a home group, I can say that through you in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am a wife, a mother, a grandmother, and a woman. Sober, free of pills, responsible. Without a higher power I found in the fellowship, my life would be meaningless. I am full of gratitude to be a member of good standing in Alcoholics Anonymous."
Yeah, so that's a really powerful reading, and it resonates quite a lot with my own experience. I guess coming in with, alcoholism was not my only problem. And we had a brief conversation about this earlier, Dawn, and you had some, we'll get more into who Father Ed was in a moment, but you had a bit of a reflection on how this relates to Father Ed as well.
Yes, well, Father Ed Dowling, like myself, was what he called underprivileged, meaning that he did not have an alcohol addiction, and so he could not be a member of AA, but he greatly admired AA's, and he believed that the 12 steps were a gift from the Holy Spirit through Bill W. to the world. And he, in a certain sense, although his prime mission as he saw it, once he discovered AA, was to encourage Bill and other AAs, he also saw the 12 steps as a means to help people overcome any problem, any addiction that they had. Father Ed suffered from an illness that led him to, think about how he had a limited amount of time to live. And so during his last years, especially the last months of his life, he started various 12-step groups for people suffering from all manner of things. And one of the groups that he helped start in late 1959, less than 6 months before his death in April 1960, he helped start a branch, what would later become the St. Louis chapter of Narcotics Anonymous. At that time, it was called Drug Addicts Anonymous, and it was started by an African-American man named Donald Mitchell. And at that time, it was illegal for people even to be drug addicts, even if they weren't people could be arrested just for saying they were a drug addict, even if they weren't carrying drugs. And so Father Ed not only gave Donald Mitchell and his fellow members of Drug Addicts Anonymous a place to meet, but also talked with local officials to make sure that the addicts wouldn't get arrested when they showed up to the meeting. So, I think that Father Ed would certainly appreciate today's reading for what it says about the love with which AA welcomes people who have problems of any kind, not only alcohol problems.
Dawn's going to share a few songs with us throughout the episode as well, which we're really excited about, especially given your history as a rock and roll journalist and longtime music fan. So excited about that. But perhaps we can sort of spend 10 minutes or so with you sort of introducing to the listener who Father Ed was and the significance that he had with his relationship with Bill W. and Alcoholics Anonymous in the early formative years, and then we could break for a song after you give us a good an introduction.
Well, as I shared, Father Ed was not an alcoholic himself. He was from St. Louis. He was born in 1898. As I mentioned, he died in 1960, and he entered the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, in 1919, and he prepared to become a priest in the Jesuits, and he found himself, although he had always been he had come from a strongly Catholic family. He had always been faithful. After he entered the Jesuits, when he was in the novitiate, the first couple of years, he found himself in this crisis of faith. He felt that the life of the Jesuits, it was very hard, yet he felt that God was calling him to it. And he started to wonder about whether God was truly good, because he wondered how could a good God be calling him to a very difficult and very possibly miserable life. Because he had, you know, prior to joining the Jesuits, he had been a star in high school and college sports. He had also spent time as a newspaper journalist. Now he was being called to celibacy and to, you know, certain rigorous practices of prayer and being kind of separated from the lives of ordinary people. So as he went through this crisis of faith, what really brought him out of it, what brought him to the point where he could, at the end of the novitiate, commit himself, vow himself to remain with the Jesuits, was the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius Loyola, which is a 30-day series of prayers and meditations that every Jesuit makes within their first year of the Jesuit novitiate. Now, when Father Ed became a priest, his fears about being separated from the lives of ordinary people were not realized, because Father Ed became a magnet for people with problems. And because he himself had endured a crisis of faith, and secondarily, because he, in his 20s, was stricken with a crippling illness, ankylosing spondylitis, an extreme form of arthritis that caused his spine and one of his legs to stiffen, calcify, made it hard for him to walk, even constricted his breathing to a certain degree, which is what ultimately killed him. Father Ed, through his experiences of suffering, particularly emotional and spiritual suffering, as I said, became a magnet for people with problems, where people were afraid to talk about their certain problems with other priests, but somehow they felt very at home with Father Ed. And on the other side of things, when I was researching the book, I found quotes from more than one person who knew Father Ed, who said that he was the only priest that they knew where they felt more comfortable coming to him with a problem than without a problem. That, you know, if they didn't have a problem, you know, they said Father Ed found them slightly boring. He really wanted to work with people with problems and to help them. And so when an alcoholic whom Father Ed was ministering to introduced him to AA, it was very early in the history of AA. It was February 1940 when Father Ed went to one of the first AA meetings in Chicago. So we're talking just, I think, 5.5 years after Dr. Bob took his last drink on or about June 10th, 1934, and only about a year or maybe even less than a year since the Big Book was published in, I believe, 1939. So at that point, very early in AA's history, when Father Ed discovered AA, he was blown away just going to this first meeting that he experienced and hearing the testimonies. He felt as though he was back in the catacombs in the early years of Christianity, that there was a great movement of the Holy Spirit going on. And he later said to his sister that the graces he experienced in working with AAs were akin to the graces that he experienced at his priestly ordination, which is an astonishing thing for a priest to say. It really shows how vocational his experience working with AAs was. But what really jump-started his interest in AA was when he, after attending that first meeting, he took a big book back to St. Louis with him from Chicago, because he was based in St. Louis, Missouri. And he showed it to a fellow Jesuit who was an alcoholic. And when this fellow Jesuit saw the big book, you know, started looking at it, he said, "Oh, well, these are the principles from our spiritual exercises." And that's when this, you know, light bulb went off in Father Ed's head, because he had believed that since experiencing his own spiritual transformation, or we could even say, you know, having a spiritual experience, spiritual awakening through making those spiritual exercises, Father Ed believed that the spiritual exercises needed to be shared with the world. He had tried to write he had written his master's thesis on the exercises, and then he tried to get his superiors to let him do a doctoral dissertation on how the exercises would provide psychological steps towards training the will to overcome bad habits. That was the topic of the doctoral thesis that he wanted to write in 1929, and his superiors denied him that. They didn't think he was meant to be an academic. They thought he was just meant to do pastoral work, which was a crushing blow for him at that time. But it turned out that was God, again, working through him, because once that fellow Jesuit pointed out to him the connections between the 12 steps, particularly, and the spiritual exercises, Father Ed realized that AA and, you know, the authors of the 12 steps had created, that they were accomplishing what he had felt was his life's mission, to share this healing message of the spiritual exercises with the world. That's when he, later in 1940, after facilitating the start of the first AA meeting in St. Louis — by the way, there are now 800 weekly AA meetings in St. Louis, is it 800 weekly or 800 monthly? I forget. Let's just say there are a lot of AA meetings in St. Louis now. So after facilitating the start of St. Louis AA in November 1940, Father Ed tracked down Bill W., not knowing that Bill W. was at that time in what he would later call a dry drunk period. That was when Bill and Lois were virtually homeless. They were living on the upper floor of the AA clubhouse in Manhattan, because they had lost Lois's family home in, I think, Brooklyn. So, you know, Father Ed came unannounced to the clubhouse, and Bill was lying splayed out on his bed with one of his imaginary ulcers, and Lois was out somewhere, and Father Ed just planted himself in a chair and said to Bill, "I'm very interested in the connections between your 12 steps and the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius Loyola." And Bill just grunted, "Never heard of him." And Father Ed laughed. And with that laugh, Bill looked at Father Ed. And Bill later said at the AA 1955 International Conference, I think it was called, International Meeting, Bill later said that when he looked over at Father Ed, he began to see what seemed like a light emanating this warmth and light from Father Ed's face that was emanating and gradually filled the room. And Bill told his biographer that he took the fifth with Father Ed. He made the fifth step, admitting his wrongs. you know, Bill had, with the first 100 members of AA, he had written the 12 steps, or I should say with the input from the first 100 members, he had written the 12 steps, but he hadn't actually made them as they were written. And so, you know, it was from that moment on that Bill took to consider Father Ed his spiritual sponsor, and that's how he would come to refer to Father Ed. And so for 20 years, the two of them had this wonderful friendship, and Bill just spoke in superlative terms about Father Ed as one of the greatest friends AA had ever known.
Thank you so much for that introduction.
You're welcome.
And which song would you like to share with us first?
Well, there's a song from Down Under, from a band that has its roots or had its roots in the Seekers. I actually wrote the sleeve notes, the booklet to the 25th anniversary collection of the Seekers back in the early 90s. It might have been the 30th anniversary collection, I forget, but I think they called it like the silver anniversary collection. Anyway, the Seekers kind of morphed after Judith Durham and most of them left. I think it was, if I remember correctly, Keith Potker who morphed the group into the new Seekers. And they had a song that was written for a television special that was made for children in the 1970s to help children feel that they could be who they wanted to be and didn't have to be bound by societal expectations according to whether they were born boys or girls or whether they were born in a particular race or class. The song is called Free to Be You and Me. And I just love it musically and lyrically. It's a very simple Woody Guthrie style, this land is your land kind of folk song. And there are certain songs that I just listen to every night before I go to bed just to help me get centered. And this is one of them.
Dawn, thank you very much for your detailed synopsis of that sort of relationship and everything too. What struck me is it's essentially a sponsor relationship as we in AA understand it. And I was wondering if in your in detailed investigation of the Bill W. Father Ed relationship, whether was there any evidence of that sort of I was going to say conflict, but probably more difficulty in the relationship, you know?
Yes. Well, I think that's a great question. And I did see certain tensions. I saw that there was a certain period where Bill seemed to be testing Father Ed. I think it was particularly in the late 1940s. And then to some degree after that, but there was a time when Bill was seriously exploring Catholicism, converting to Catholicism, and he would write to Father Ed with questions about Catholicism, and then he'd write to Father Ed saying that he was receiving instruction in Catholicism from the Monsignor Fulton J. Sheen, who became Archbishop Sheen. Incidentally, and this is something that I hadn't even thought of with its connection to AA, but just this week, I guess it'll be last week by the time this show airs on March 31st, it was announced by the Vatican that Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen will be beatified in St. Louis, interestingly enough, on September 24th. So when someone on the path to sainthood is beatified, made a blessed, it's the last step before canonization. It means that there's been a miracle that's been seen to have happened through that person's intercession. So actually, now that I think about it, we can say that Bill W. received instruction in Catholicism from a blessed of the Catholic Church. Monsignor, then Archbishop, later Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen. Anyway, so going back to your question, so in my Father Ed biography, drawing upon the correspondence between Bill and Father Ed, I talk about how there seems to be an undercurrent when Bill writes to Father Ed about his receiving instruction in Catholicism, and then he writes his questions. I detect what seems to be an undercurrent of Bill wondering whether Father Ed would still love him, would still accept him if he didn't become Catholic. There's on the one hand, it seems like Bill wants Father Ed's approval. Look at me, I'm studying your faith. You've made the faith seem so attractive to me that I want to learn it. And I'm just this close. I'm so close to becoming Catholic. And, you know, this goes on for a while. And Father Ed, he recognizes that Bill is speaking more enthusiastically than he may actually be. I actually found correspondence between Father Ed and a friend of his where he writes that he uses some weather expression. I forget what the expression is, but Father Ed's writing to a friend of his and saying, yes, you know, Bill is talking very excitedly about Catholicism, but I think he's really in a temperate zone or something like that. So Father Ed, I think, recognized that he was being tested, and you can see it's visible in his correspondence that he's got a certain reticence. He definitely wants to be present for Bill and answer Bill's questions about Catholicism, and he doesn't want to do anything that would turn Bill away from Catholic faith or make Bill feel that he would be unwelcome in Catholic faith, but he's very careful not to, you know, let on that, oh my gosh, I would love it for you to become Catholic sort of thing. He wants to give Bill as much freedom, you know, as he can. And that is actually something where Father Ed's Jesuit training would have come into play, because in the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius Loyola, there are instructions given to the spiritual director who is leading someone through the exercises. And St. Ignatius Loyola tells the spiritual director to be conscious of like where the Holy Spirit is leading the person making the exercises. And so it's not the director's job to try to second guess the Holy Spirit and to try to, you know, take on for himself the role of judging what the person should or should not choose, but rather the spiritual director's job is to help the person they're directing to make room for the Holy Spirit so that they can go wherever the Spirit's leading them. And that's really what Father Ed is doing. He's not trying to push Bill one way or another, but he's giving Bill the information Bill needs. And then ultimately what happened was Bill decided not to become Catholic. He had certain intellectual objections to Catholicism, like infallibility. That was a big problem for him, the idea that any human being could be infallible. So papal infallibility, you know, he couldn't handle that. But moreover, and I believe this is the overriding reason why Bill didn't become Catholic, because Bill was concerned, and I hate to say this as a Catholic, but he was given, put it this way, Yes, would I have loved for Bill to become Catholic? In one sense, I would have. I think it would have been better for him. I think he would have been happier in many ways. But for AA, I think, you know, from an AA perspective, I think Bill was correct in being concerned that if he became Catholic, people would think that AA was a Catholic movement and it could prevent people from healing. And, you know, I hate to spoil things for your listeners. I certainly hope that every listener picks up a copy of my Father Ed biography and, you know, reads it through to the end themselves. But you know, since you asked the question and, you know, since it has to do with what you asked, you know, I will say that towards the very end of the book, Father Ed, in correspondence, talks to Bill about the Catholic teaching of baptism by desire, the idea that someone who, for whatever reason, on a practical level, can't get baptized, could still experience the graces of baptism through their inward desire. And, you know, that really intrigued Bill, and learning about that gave Bill, I believe, a certain amount of peace in his belief that as a co-founder of AA, he could not formally enter the Catholic Church.
And there might be a good time to pause for the second of your song selections. What song would you like to choose for us next?
Let's go for Lou Christie. And so I was blessed to know Lou Christie. At one point, briefly, he wanted me to be the ghostwriter on his memoir. That didn't pan out, but I was grateful to know him. And he died last year, 2025, and he was he was certainly a spiritual person, a sincere Catholic, although he also wrestled with Catholicism, and you hear that a lot in his songs. There's no question in my mind that he was very much God-haunted in the best possible way. He didn't write Beyond the Blue Horizon. It's an old song that was in one of those classic operetta films with Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald back in, I guess, the 1930s or so. But he really made Beyond the Blue Horizon his own. And if you've seen the movie Rain Man, you'll recognize this song, I believe, from the opening credits. And I just think he sings like an angel. This is another of those songs that I listen to every night. And it's just so warm, so hopeful. I also love how, you know, when you hear it, you'll hear that, first of all, Lou eases into it. You hear his voice kind of fade up when he's in this, he begins the verse like, you know, the voice is very faint. And then, you know, by the end of that verse, his voice is at full volume. And then likewise, his voice fades out. And one just kind of gets that sense that his voice is itself starting out beyond the horizon and then rising up like the sun and then going back down over the horizon. You know, I never realized that was what it was until describing it to you right now. So I hope your listeners enjoy it.
Yes, I can see what you mean about his voice heading to the horizon and everything too. Given the connection between Bill and Father Ed was the deep connection between the spiritual exercises of Saint Ignatius Loyola and the 12 steps and everything too, I was wondering, would you feel comfortable sharing with us what you see the connection being?
Well, I appreciate the question. It is something that I've thought about a lot with regard to what bonded Bill W. and Father Ed. there are a couple of things that I touch on in my book with regard to what really drew them together. I want to preface this by reassuring listeners that the things that are my ideas, I just kind of propose them in the book. I don't try to make them as final conclusions because I wasn't there. I didn't interview Bill or Father Ed. Someone else might read about their correspondences and find things that that I didn't, you know, really notice or interpret correctly. But with that said, that anything I propose is just, you know, tentative. I will say that one thing that I think gives insight into Bill's and Father Ed's relationship is that whereas they both played baseball in high school and were very into it, Bill was a pitcher, whereas Father Ed was a catcher. And there's a classic article from the Atlantic magazine in, I think, the 1940s by the great baseball player Mo Berg called Pitchers and Catchers, that talks about this symbiotic relationship that pitchers and catchers have. And one of the lines in it, which I quote in Father Ed, is where Mo Berg speaks about the catcher as being the, forgive my pronunciation, but I think he says the catcher is the Cerberus of, C-E-R-B-E-R-U-S, the Cerberus of the baseball diamond. Cerberus was the mythical Greek hound outside of Hades, who, if I recall correctly, had multiple heads to try to prevent people from outside from going down to Hades. And I saw a parallel with that to Father Ed as Bill's catcher, you know, helping prevent Bill, you know, during his times of depression from going to, you know, hellish thoughts. But more than that, I also see that it wasn't just a question of Bill, or rather, it wasn't just a question of Father Ed fulfilling a certain role for Bill, but also Bill filled an important gap in Father Ed's life. I'm sure that as a sponsor, Martin, that you find that, you know, sponsorship is not a one-way street. And I mean, as I understand it, you know, as what Father Ed would call an underprivileged person, non-AA person, you know, I understand that, you know, the 12th step work is how, you know, through, you know, practicing these principles, you maintain your sobriety through that outreach that includes sponsorship. And so, you know, for Father Ed, I think Father Ed's core issue, the hole that he inside that he that could not be filled for him was this loneliness, and this, I believe that it was loneliness that drove Father Ed to chain smoke. Now, he did eventually overcome his chain smoking. Maybe it wasn't chain smoking, but it was smoking. Certainly, he had a smoking habit that he overcame with the 12 steps. I believe also that it was that core sense of loneliness that drove him to binge eat at times, and he never overcame his struggles with eating. Although, you know, he would have his more kind of abstemious times, but it was always hard for him. And Father Ed, like Bill, had experienced loss in his family at a young age. In Father Ed's case, it was when he was in his late teens, I think around 18, his younger brother, James Dowling, died in the 1918 flu pandemic. And so I feel that even though Bill was chronologically 3 years older than Father Ed, I believe that Bill kind of became in some way a surrogate figure or substitute for Father Ed's younger his late younger brother. An interesting aspect of this is that whenever Bill described his first meeting with Father Ed, he would refer to Father Ed as the old priest. Now, certainly Father Ed looked old before his time. He was prematurely gray. He used a cane from an early age. But still, at that first meeting in November 1940 at the AA clubhouse, Father Ed was 42 and Bill was 45. And yet, Bill, telling the story, would say that the old priest. So I think that tells you something about the way that Bill looked up to Father Ed as a father figure or an older brother figure.
It's interesting, isn't it, that that you describe the loneliness that Father Ed experienced, because in the literature, Bill talks about the chilling vapor of loneliness and talks about how only the alcoholic can actually experience that level of sort of loneliness and stuff like that. So, again, a very deep bond between the two, isn't it? You know, the notion of mutual suffering and everything too.
Your book, I believe it's stocked in New Zealand at Paper Plus, and people can get hold of it there. But I'm sure it's also available at the usual sort of online places, Amazon and such. Where would you suggest people might get it from if they were looking for it?
I certainly would love it if you would patronize your local bookstores and ask them to stock Father Ed. American publisher is Orbis Books. I don't recall offhand who is the New Zealand distributor, but I could try to find that out for you. But I would say if you can support Paper Plus, that would be great, because from an author's perspective, we need more like brick and mortar bookstores and local booksellers. So thank you for supporting them.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real honor and privilege. And it does feel really grace, sort of these moments of grace that brought, you know, Martin and I together and you and I together and myself to the program. And, you know, it's quite an amazing thing that I am still blown away by. But I think you've got one more song that you'd like to finish off on. But, so thank you so much. And any final words before you sort of introduce and send us out with your last song?
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, this has just been such a joy for me speaking with both of you, and I'm thrilled to reach your listeners and to share Father Ed's story. I've enjoyed this interview so much. I've enjoyed your questions and just the depth of the questions, so thank you. This last song is by The Millennium, a studio group from Los Angeles. It was recorded in 1968. This is one of the very first records made in 16-track for you audiophiles. The engineer, Keith Olson, or one of the engineers, along with another one, Roy Haley, jerry-rigged two 8-track recorders to create a 16-track recording. The drums on, this is actually like two songs linked together, Prelude, which is the instrumental, and then to Claudia on Thursday, and the drums on Prelude have been sampled by like rap artists and stuff because they're huge and way ahead of their time. And it's only two instrumentalists playing on Prelude. And that was part of the benefit of having 16 tracks for 1968. The idea that two people could do an entire like full band kind of almost orchestral sound. And then to Claudia on Thursday has a phenomenal vocal sound that was the arrangements vocally were by this producer named Kurt Becher, B-O-E-T-T-C-H-E-R, first name C-U-R-T. Kurt Becher's work was, discovering his work in this album was life-changing for me during my days as a rock and roll historian. So I hope you all enjoy. This is one of my, you know, all-time favorite recordings.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.